Hello and welcome everyone back to another episode of the Publisher Lab. I'm Tyler Bishop, and we're trying to like Black Diamond this new setup, you know, with Whitney, my co-host. Welcome again, Whitney. Welcome back. Welcoming you also from a remote location. So we decided we wanted to increase the difficulty levels and put our producer Manny like to the test, you know.
Yeah, this is like the boss level of the Publisher Lab. So yeah, we're both remote today, figuring it out. I think we finally did. We got a new system up. And yeah, you know, this is 2023. This stuff should work well, right?
Yeah,
you know, after the pandemic.
it's amazing the dramatic improvement, I would say, that hardware has had over the years. Yet, like the software doesn't seem to have like caught up necessarily yet. You know, it's like you can have a video camera that records and uploads things in 4K, yet, you know, to get the stream to actually work and hopefully it's recording, you know, those types of things still seem to be a bit of a struggle.
Yeah. Well, luckily we have somebody like Manny doing most of that for us. Cause he has always knows what he's doing. If he doesn't, he knows how to troubleshoot. So it's been a good experiment, but we have some good topics on the docket today. Most of it, actually only one of it has to do with AI today, which I know is a shocker, but there is other stuff going on in digital publishing.
What could it be?
I know. So it's, once I say what they are, you're going to be like, that makes sense. So Google is delaying its EU launch of AI chatbot after privacy regulation concerns. Facebook traffic is falling and how you can combat the decline. And then making money on YouTube just got easier. So we'll just jump right in to the EU is not going to launch its AI chatbot after privacy regulation concerns. It's delayed the launch of its generative AI chatbot Bard in the European Union, and it's unclear when they'll launch it. So there's been some concerns with Google, and it's awaiting a response from Google regarding those concerns. When this came out and I was looking at it, I think yesterday, Google had not provided adequate information and documentation to ease those worries. So just OpenAI's rival chatbot, ChatGPT has been freely accessible in the EU since its research preview, like since it first came out. So I think Bard is struggling to get its feet in the EU, and it doesn't really seem like it's happening anytime soon. It's pretty open-ended at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the problem that a lot of the big tech platforms are going to have, sort of trying to keep up and make promises with it, with AI and some of the advancements. So like, you know, you think about it, Google has a brand, they're a public company. So if something looks like a total, I mean, I don't, you know what, I'll just say a crap show. I know that you worried about the first 15 minutes and curse words. So you guys know the other word, but if it's basically just like a goat wrangle and like, it doesn't look good, you know, that could affect things like the stock price. You know, you've got a lot of different stakeholders at Google, lots of egos, assumingly, not just Google, but every big company is going to have that. And so when you end up with something like that, what happens is that you have to have these like sort of like committed projects. And if you say something publicly that you're going to do or offer, then you have to do it. And if you don't, and you have to issue statements about delays and things like that. Meanwhile, if you're a AI startup or, you know, somebody with a little bit less that you have to manage, you know, you can move so much more like quickly and have some agility in the way that you launch and distribute things. So I think in general, what we're going to see is that Google is going to be behind everybody else. And hopefully that means that, you know, they'll find ways to integrate it into their existing products that people use faster. But I wouldn't expect for them to have the best version of anything the soonest, or maybe even ever, because their real value add in this point is, they kind of remind me of if people will remember the game consoles, you know, like Whitney, at what age did you stop playing video games, or have you stopped? Are you still play games at all?
I kind of stopped with PS2, honestly, which I know is like forever ago, but I wasn't a big gamer anyway. We just always had a console and I'd hop on every once in a while. But like basically once my brother got an Xbox, I was like, not interested.
Yeah, I mean, so once I like basically got out of college, I stopped being a gamer completely. But I did, but it was right around the time that, like, I think maybe PS3, Xbox, whatever version of it was competitive there. But Nintendo had been keeping up for the longest time. Like, I remember Nintendo 64, for those that have no idea for references. It was kind of like an arms race between Microsoft, Sony, and Nintendo to have the best system in terms of like being able to render the best games, the most sort of like high quality graphics, all that kind of stuff. But it got to a point where Nintendo instead focused more on the user's experience. So like that's where you get things like the Wii and sort of like the, you know, hand motion type technologies and things like that, because it was really novelty and the user that made the most sense there for them. And I think that that's going to be Google's role here with AI as well, is they're not necessarily going to be able to keep up, I don't think, with the innovation in terms of like the most advanced deep learning models. But I do think that they'll be able to keep up in terms of, you know, making some of the best products that people need to use. But that's just my free advice.
Yeah, like I was saying, I think that Google was kind of behind on this in the first place. And I think that where Google can really shine is, like you said, like putting it in its existing products and like kind of implementing it that way, but trying to keep up with it and like trying to like, I guess, like push Bard in as much as possible. I just think that ChatGPT is just so much farther ahead and more advanced and people like it more at this point. So it's not that they shouldn't continue to develop Bard, but I don't think that should be their main focus.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. And I think if they're smart, they'll listen to their users. I always think, I mean, like publishers know this as much as anybody, but if you're making decisions without looking at your user data, and I don't mean like, you know, what you think they're behaving like, I mean like what they actually are doing. And if they look at the metrics from something like Bard and they find that people are not using the majority of the tool or not using it how they imagine, they should pivot quickly. And that has not been a strength of theirs in the past.
Agreed. Speaking of companies that should pivot quickly, why Facebook traffic is falling? So publishers referral traffic from Facebook has been declining industry-wide. The decline in Facebook traffic began around the middle of last year and has been steadily falling since then. So in the past, referral traffic has kind of shown peaks and valleys. So people aren't super concerned that it's, you know, not, that it's going to be something big and that it's just a, you know, it's just a temporary thing is what some people are saying. But because Facebook remains the largest source of social referral traffic for publishers. And so I think that this is still really important to some publishers. And so some of it could be, you know, due to its fight with legislators lately, people are kind of backing off Facebook. But ultimately, what I have seen in general is just that shift from Facebook onto other platforms has been slowly happening anyway. And this is just maybe following a pattern of ups and downs. But like, I think in general, Facebook is becoming more and more obsolete as far as like traffic concerns. I think that they have a lot of places they could pivot outside of a social networking platform, but I don't think they're going to do it. I think they're going to hold on to the bitter end. But what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think Facebook, I was a lot more optimistic about their business and their opportunities maybe a year or two ago, because Instagram still seemed to be the platform that could adopt pretty much. They could steal like the most recent social platform innovations, add it to theirs, and it seemed to work. Facebook, on the other hand, like, you know, a lot of their growth is really associated with developments in countries that have, you know, predominantly not had fast internet or even internet access at all. And they've come in and they've kind of done a lot of what ISPs have done in the US. And I think we talked about this on a previous podcast, but they sort of are incumbent. You can kind of think of them as the MSN.com. We have some publishers on the podcast that remember back whenever it was the default home screen for a lot of internet service providers. And so because of that, like, there's some baked in user growth that happened there that is not artificial. It's just that, you know, it's sort of forced. And at some point, you know, those users start falling off and more people become incumbent there in terms of competitors. So you have this kind of perfect storm where it's like, you know, it may be waning in terms of popularity or as a destination for social media. And then on top of that, you know, they seem to not really know their way forward in terms of the roadmap for Facebook proper. They seem very focused on all the other projects. Instagram maybe has a roadmap, but it seems like Facebook, they kind of like waver back and forth. And every 6 months, there's a new announcement about what their focus is going to be on the newsfeed. Election cycles seem to help them a lot. So we've got one of those coming up in the next few years. So that may like kind of sustain the slow growth for a little bit. But I would say that in a few years without anything changing, I don't see a path where it looks like Facebook is, you know, near as relevant as it is today for websites that, that garner traffic from it.
I totally agree. And, you know, this is something we'll repeat over and over again. You should never be referring on or you should never be relying on an outside source for your traffic anyway. And so if you're really worried about Facebook traffic declining over the next couple of years, it's time to pivot anyway. So I would suggest finding ways that you can invest in your audience, the audience that you have, which, you know, includes maybe emails and finding topics that your audience finds really valuable and finding new ways of gaining traffic rather than relying on Facebook. But, you know, an AI is helping, can help you do a bazillion things and make your list so much shorter. So, you know, Facebook, getting rid of Facebook as a source you rely on might be something to tick off your list.
Yeah. I mean, I'd always liken it to renting versus buying where it's, you know, when you, a lot of people, they can't afford to buy a home, especially when they get out of school. So you have to rent and that's how you, you know, sustain yourself until you're able to save up enough money to buy a home. And I think that that's really how audience building should be looked at as well, where it's like, you know, you're gonna have to rent, you know, an audience from some of these platforms and Google included in that for a long time. And then eventually you'll have saved up an audience to where you don't necessarily have to buy, if you will, space on the platforms, meaning like you go all in and I'm a YouTuber or whatever. You can continue to rent offices around the world at that point, but you need to have a home base that you've paid for and that's your audience. So I think that analogy still applies.
I don't know if I've ever heard you say that analogy before, but it makes a lot of sense. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. It's been a couple of years
now. I get the Super Bowl one too, where they talk about how like there's different types of audiences, but mainly from an advertiser perspective.
Oh, yeah. No, I've heard your Super Bowl reference for sure. I think honestly, if I had to give Facebook a position to a path to follow, I think that it shines in its events, like planning events, but only works if people have Facebook. Mm-hmm. And then also its marketplace. I just think that those are its two shining things it should focus on, and the rest of it, you know,
I think you want Facebook to be a better Craigslist.
Yes, I do. And that's how I use it. So
yeah. And I think, you know, the challenge for them is because they are so many people do have Facebook accounts and they've done a good job of making their SDK available to developers so that you can do like the Facebook login. They've sort of like blended it into Messenger, which is, you know, like in WhatsApp. So, you know, those two things are like things that a lot of people across the world are sort of stuck using in a lot of ways. So they have that audience from that respect. So they try to keep everybody centralized. So like, you know, Marketplace competes a little bit with either a Craigslist or something like that. Events, kind of the same types of players. You could throw maybe Nextdoor into that for different people and stuff like that. So for them, I think they sort of see themselves as like, we just need to duplicate all the other stuff out there and then our audience will stay with us rather than moving off. But, you know, from a publisher's perspective, you know, there's not anything Facebook is doing in that regard that really is to their benefit or our benefit as a publisher. So, you know, I would say that regardless of whether or not Facebook continues to thrive and grow as a business, for publishers, I can't see it doing anything but growing less relevant.
Definitely.
Hi, everyone. My name is Charlie, and I'm a technical publisher advocate here at Zoic. And I'm here to tell you about Zoic Ads. Did you know that you can maximize your website monetization using a Zoic sophisticated AI? You can cater a different ad experience to each individual user going to your site. It's true. It's called Ad Tester, and you can automatically trigger multivariate testing to run thousands of experiments at once. You choose your goals and let Azoic optimize each unique visit around them. Publishers have seen an increase of average monthly revenue by 36%. So what are you waiting for? Sign your site up to Azoic and join the thousands of other publishers maximizing their revenue today.
And so something that's hoping to become more relevant is YouTube. They are making it easier for people to make money off of their videos. So it's changed its eligibility rules for earning money through its YouTube partner program. And it now allows creators to access it earlier, you know, giving you an opportunity to make revenue through fan funding features like channel membership, super chat, super thanks. And so now the threshold is 500 subscribers, 3 public uploads in the last 90 days, 3,000 watch hours in the past year, or 3 million shorts views over the previous 90 days. Used to, you know, you have to be like 1,000 subscribers and 4,000 watch hours. So they've lowered it quite a bit. And I think this is a direct competitive move against platforms like TikTok, and, you know, giving people, trying to get people monetizing on YouTube rather than switching over to TikTok and abandoning YouTube.
Probably Patreon and Substack as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not super familiar with Substack, but yeah, Patreon as well. I think it's just like this move to be more competitive in the space, whereas, you know, originally it was the space.
Yeah. No, and it definitely still is in terms of it having a network effect, but I think that they're late here, and it kind of probably goes back to what we were talking about at the start of the podcast, but, you know, you think about it, like the reason why, you know, I think YouTube is focused on sort of the features of what like creators are looking for, which is, you know, things like being able to have paid users, subscriptions, alternative forms of monetization, more control over like how they present to their audiences and how they interact with them. But the reason why publishers want those things is because they want more control. And the reason is for the rent versus buy thing. It's like, I don't want to be renting everything from YouTube. And I definitely don't want their hands in all my money. So like the reason why you would, you know, build a platform on your own website, upload your own video, have your own subscription payment process, like do it all yourself essentially, is because no one is going to put their hands in your money and take it. And beyond that, even like nobody's going to have their hands in your audience. So if you're a creator that is pulling all of your audience purely because you're a creator and they're coming to you, and YouTube, it's just, you know, happens to be on YouTube, then like YouTube offers no value. You should give them no money. But most sites and most publishers are going, and even creators are going to rely some amount on, you know, YouTube's algorithm. So that's fine. You can build on that platform, but realistically, it's like, you know, anybody that's coming to see you, you want that control. And so I do think that it may actually hurt YouTube in the long run, because you hand these publishers features at the very start, and the second they, you know, maybe start to build something on there that's considerable, you know, they're going to probably branch out and continue to figure out how they can improve and find that, you know, there's better alternatives that you can use if you want to monetize your, you know, your audience that way. And you should, because, yeah, it's less rigid. However, I do think that this maybe takes something away from the Patreons of the world in the short term. The TikToks, I don't see it. I really like the YouTube stories, but I get the feeling that they're not getting strong uptake. And that's purely just speculation based on my observations of people that I know that use the platform and then also are on YouTube constantly.
Yeah, I feel like I don't know as many people who are YouTube obsessed as they are like TikTok obsessed. And partially that might just be like the people I'm surrounding myself with, or like younger people that I am surrounding myself with, that, you know, they grew up on YouTube, but they have not adopted shorts the same way that they've adopted.
That's exactly TikTok. What I've seen too. And I think that if it's the younger audiences that have, you know, that's their behavior, it's just a matter of time.
Yeah, exactly. I haven't really seen any shorts. I don't really get on YouTube unless I need something. Some people like are, you know, they have like shows they watch. I have a podcast or two that I might watch if I feel like, you know, actually watching them. Otherwise, I just listen to it. But I don't usually go to YouTube unless I need to know how to do something or I want an idea for something. And that's just always been my behavior. I know that's not everybody's behavior my age and, you know, on both sides of my generational group. There are people that love YouTube. And so they might be, you know, more into YouTube shorts where, you know, they might not download TikTok. But I think, yeah, kind of like we were saying, like younger generations are, that's where they're at. They're on TikTok for the most part. And I just don't see them adopting shorts. I don't know. What do you think that YouTube would have to do? Maybe this is too big of a question because otherwise, you know, you'd be running YouTube. But what do you think the YouTube has to do in order to try to catch up to something like TikTok and like be more relevant?
You know, I don't know that they can. I think it may be the wrong mission. If they wanted to do it, you know, the only thing that I can think of are things that are, I would consider really risky to their mainline business. So I wouldn't do it. But it's basically like a complete restructuring of the UI UX. It's like, I mean, you saw it with Instagram and, they got a lot of flack for it, but I honestly think it probably panned out for them where there was a extreme emphasis posted, put onto Reels and, you know, like it disrupts user behavior because if you're used to being able to scroll through your feed and you're having a completely different experience and next thing you know, it's like, you're basically having a TikTok experience because you've started viewing a video or something like that. At first that can be jarring, but you know, like the addictive quality of that sort of short form autoplay video, you know, it captures people, but they're there basically looking for that already. With YouTube, I think it would be far more disruptive if all of a sudden you went to YouTube to search for something and you're getting like, especially on your phone, basically the TikTok experience where it's like, you know, I think people kill time a lot of times on social media. And, you know, on YouTube, if you're basically making it harder to find what you're looking for, I think, you know, like, yeah, it's like you'll go elsewhere or you'll use Google as a search engine as opposed to YouTube, which YouTube gets a considerable amount of people that use it as a search engine, like firsthand. So.
Oh, yeah, I totally. I'd go right in there and ask how to do stuff all the time, ask it questions all the time. I think that's really kind of the difference in YouTube and TikToks is that YouTube started out as long form content and I think it really still thrives there. I understand that like they need to try new things and try this like short form vertical video and stuff, but I just don't think that's, yeah, I don't think that, I think they're past the point where they can like catch up to something like TikTok and doesn't mean they should stop doing shorts. I just don't know, you know, how long it's going to last. And like you said, I think finding other ways to monetize your video content really makes a big difference when stuff like this happens, you know, because like they could change the eligibility again anytime they want to, and they could make it harder. And so
there used to not really be any set criteria, like in the regard of like, you know, the watch hours and things like that. And I think a lot of people that were burned by that or found that like distasteful for whatever reason. But I remember having a YouTube channel in the, you know, back in the early days when you could first monetize and being surprised at how much money that my audience was already generating. It wasn't a lot, but it was enough to basically encourage me to want to keep going. And I wonder how much that they have potentially hurt sort of like, I guess like their long-term growth. Like the, like a few years ago when they started doing this, like it's really hard to measure how many people basically just didn't keep going. You know, something we talk a lot about at Azoic is like what types of things like generally help a publisher like stick with it that's growing. And you know, there's no one answer, and I think that, you know, like for that reason YouTube may have done more harm here than they realize.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that, you know, harkening back to Facebook, it's just another one of those things where you can't rely on other platforms to be to save you or, you know, be your holy grail or whatever you want to call it, you know, the source of all your traffic and all of your revenue, because this changed for the better. Obviously, you know, creators can, you know, make money earlier now, but like I said, they can change it again at any time if it's not working for YouTube. And so if you're relying on something like this, it can really rock your world if they decide to change it in any way that isn't advantageous to you. So finding other ways to monetize your any of your content, but then also your video content is just really important.
And I know that there's publishers that are listening or watching this, this is like classic history lesson where they would probably warn anybody on this podcast that hasn't been doing this for a couple decades or just a decade even, because the thing is that this happens over and over and over again, whether it's Google or Facebook or Twitter or Alta Vista. It doesn't really matter where like the dominant source of traffic comes from. Like it doesn't even have to be that the platform goes away. The platform can just shift. It's like, you know, a lot of people made money off of Facebook pages, you know, 7-8 years ago, and they could build them quickly. And today it's like, it's a losing strategy.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's all definitely true. All empires fall. So, you know, when's it going to be YouTube's turn? We'll find out. Or really Google's, but I think the next 10 years are just going to be so interesting in digital publishing. As far as like, who's, you know, is Google going to have to break up a little bit? Is, you know, YouTube going to lose its popularity? Is TikTok going to get banned? Is AI going to take over everything? I think that, I think that's also something we've mentioned here before. Just like the next 10 years, next 15 years, it's going to change drastically and, you know, be prepared for it. It's going to be interesting.
Absolutely. And, you know, we had a great question at the end of our last podcast. I think somebody had asked me about Markdown, and I gave an answer that probably scared everybody away from asking more questions because it was kind of a long one.
He did reply. He said, thank you.
Oh, nice. So I have good news if you're listening. So one of the things that I've been experimenting with was, so one of the sort of the strategy behind it is that there's been no web protocol for what they call portable content for a long time. So you can kind of think of portable content for those that are familiar with the idea of like a headless CMS or something like that. But realistically, it's like the reason why people install themes in a WordPress website or, you know, move from Wix to WordPress or WordPress to you name it is because you basically want to change something about your site, but you don't want to mess up one, like any of the SEO stuff that you've done to the site, whether it's meta stuff in the background, whatever. So when you change just about anything, especially CMSs or whatever, like all the different fields and things like that, that populate that data that you filled in or added to your site, like if it changes even a little bit, it's like, we all know those things can affect sort of like the way that your site is either indexed or crawled or maybe even like ranked in the index. But beyond that, even it's just the content itself. Like if you move from one thing to the next, how many people have changed their theme on a WordPress site or migrated their site, and all of a sudden it's like nothing looks the way that it's supposed to or in the right places, or you lose something. So the idea behind the Markdown thing is that you would want to capture standardization of all that stuff, everything that's done for SEO, everything that is the content that users see, and basically make it like modular to where it's like, you know, your author name, put it wherever you need to. You could, you know, show it as a preview along with the description in one place and then, you know, display it in the article in the other, and you know where those things are at. And WordPress does that through a multitude of plugins, themes, and other things. So moving it around is really hard. So one of the things that I wanted to build was I built a plugin that automatically exports site's content and then automatically makes it into like Markdown files that actually marry together all the stuff for SEO that publishers actually use and their content. So then you can just take these Markdown files and you literally could just like, you could put it anywhere. So you could get it indexed. You could, you know, take it over to a headless CMS like that. You can host it for free. There's like really, really cool things you can do with it. But the problem is that nobody that builds this stuff is a publisher. So they have no idea what people actually are trying to accomplish. So realistically, what I've put together is kind of like, it's an experiment at best, but next episode, I'll tell people where they can download it. And then I would highly recommend that you would basically just read the sort of like the summary of it. So I think realistically, this is something that maybe publishers with a more technical understanding could experiment with, or maybe even just play with on a test site or something. But I think it would give people a really good start to this idea of having your content be portable so that AI systems, people, indexes all around the world or platforms, you could basically send pieces of your content out there easily. It makes it easier for AI to market it. But yeah, it was just kind of a for fun project. It's not a product or anything to sell. It's just some free software for people if they're interested. And I'll put it up on my GitHub and tell people where to get it.
Yeah, that sounds great. Maybe back up your website before start messing around.
Yeah, I recommend you don't do this unless you kind of like want to experiment and generally understand kind of what's happening. But I'll kind of lay it out and who I think should maybe try it and how.
Sounds good. Can't wait to see it. Well, was there anything else that you wanted to touch on besides your secret special project?
It's not a secret special project. It is just a hobby. I don't want to sell it too hard because it realistically it's something that I'm going to be learning along the way as well. But
yeah,
no, I think that that's it. It's a really exciting time for publishers. The more and more stuff that I'm able to use and sort of like get my hands on from an AI perspective, I find that it's making accomplishing things so much easier and faster. Yeah. And mm-hmm. you know, we talked about this a lot the last podcast. That's absolutely what publishers need to be doing right now, is you need to be thinking about every single thing you do and how do I basically like not have to do that anymore. And you'll find the stuff that you just can't say, well, AI just definitely, this is me. I know this information. I'm going to have to tell the AI this. That's the stuff that you should do.
Yeah. What's that? Wasn't there like a phrase or something? It's like, there's an app for that. Wasn't that like,
yeah.
There's like, now it's like, there's AI for that.
You know, that might've like, been literally anything slogan.
That you could want to do. Was it? Yeah, that makes sense. You heard it here first. There's AI. There's an AI for that. So,
yep.
Go out and
marketing agencies, the world, send Whitney money.
Send me money, please. Okay. Well, that's all we have for this episode of the Publisher Lab. If you would like to watch us on YouTube, we are on our YouTube channel. You can find us on Ezoic's YouTube channel. You can find us on all podcasting platforms. We have publisherlab.org where you can find the episodes, but then also leave a comment, a question, concern, any advice you want to give us for maybe doing podcasts remotely, any topics you want us to cover, you can leave us something there. You can leave us a YouTube comment, leave us a review on whatever podcasting platform you use. We'd love some new reviews on there. I think we have some good ones on there, but they're from a little while ago. So we could use some new reviews on there. I know that some of you are enjoying the podcast because I see it on YouTube. So if you could head on over and give us a rating, we would really appreciate that. And this has been another episode of the Publisher Lab.